This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, and I'm not Tom Hartman. He's on an airplane. We talked to him yesterday from Nairobi, Kenya, as he was returning from his very important trip to Darfur. And Tom will be arriving back in his home in Portland. He thinks about midnight tonight, and he says sleep is overrated, so he expects to be back on the air in Portland and on this national program tomorrow. And I'm sure that's going to happen because Tom is one of the hardest working people in talk radio. I'm delighted to be sitting in for Tom again today. My name's Peter B. Collins. I'm based in San Francisco. Want to know more about me? I've got a website, peterbcollins.com. Doesn't everybody? We're at the Take Back America Conference, where progressives have convened here. This is my third year attending the conference. It's been underway in this form for about 5 years. And it's exciting and just really gratifying to see so many progressives gather in this important election year. In a moment, Joe Andrews will join us, the former chair of the Democratic National Committee. Jared Bernstein from the Economic Policy Institute will help us understand Wall Street's meltdown and what it means to the average American working family. Drew Weston is a professor from North Carolina, I think. I'll get that to you in a couple of minutes. Oh, I've got it right over here. Let's see. Something like that. He wrote a book, and we'll talk about it. Also, Congressman John Conyers, Democrat from Michigan, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, will be with us later this hour. And I will ask him to respond to the very important and powerful speech that Barack Obama just concluded about half an hour ago in Philadelphia. I must say, I was quite impressed. So there's a lot to talk about. If you want to join this conversation, you can do so. We'll try to squeeze in calls as we take different guests during every segment. The toll-free number is 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. Joe Andrew joins us now. He's a Hoosier, and nobody should hold that against him. Joe, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
You are the youngest chair in Democratic National Committee history.
You know, I always wish there was some other adjective than just youngest, but I think you're absolutely right. I think I headed over David Wilhelm by 6 days.
Uh-huh.
So I always say that David looks younger, seems younger, you know, a better guy just
uh-huh.
all over than I was as well.
You're aging gracefully.
Well, thank you very much.
You have most of your hair.
Yes.
I can't say that.
But it was a great, like with David's tenure there, a great privilege and honor to have had that job. Unfortunately, I got it doing from two constitutional crises, from the impeachment of the president to the recount in Florida.
Right.
So
yeah.
It was a fun time.
Well, let's talk about the current crises with the Democratic National
Absolutely.
Committee. Florida has said there will be no revote, no mail-in vote, no caucuses. The January results will stand, and they will sit during the first, at least the
it's
first vote at the convention.
It's unbelievable.
Now, I actually think this is the right decision. I think that changing the rules in the middle of the game would leave no one happy and would create the perception that politics had intervened to benefit probably Hillary in this case because of the way that vote turned out in January. And I don't fault the Democrats in Florida. It was the Republican legislature and Charlie Crist who moved up the primary defiance of the DNC. And do you have any hope that some rationality will descend on the states and that in the 2012 primaries that we can do this without everybody trying to jump to the front? California did it. That's where I'm from. And it was exciting to be part of the process for a change. But, hey, Puerto Rico is going to be part of the process, and they're right at the end of the line.
That's right. Well, Peter, as you may know, I've been a very vocal critic of these rules since I was the chair in 2000, because it seems to me that for those of us who, for example, do not like the Electoral College, we think that because Al Gore got 575,000 more votes than
mm-hmm.
George Bush, that he should have been the president, it's a little hard to argue that the person who doesn't just get the most votes ought to be the Democratic nominee as well. So while I am a Hillary Clinton supporter, I believe very much in this basic principle that we ought to simply have a system in place,
mm-hmm.
not of caucuses, but just of primaries, and whoever gets the most votes ought to be the nominee. That ought to be the rules. In fact, as you may have seen, most polls show you that most people think that is the way that it actually happens.
Right.
And I don't think that just because of my tenure of being involved in politics that somehow my vote means more than the guy who delivers my mail or the woman who checked me out at the grocery store yesterday.
You're a super D.
I happen to be a super delegate. But to show you how crazy these rules are, It's like English peerage, right? Well, senators are superdelegates as long as they have the office of being a senator. I am a superdelegate for the rest of my life.
Oh, my Lord.
Right? So it's like,
I should call you my lord, right?
Exactly.
You're in the House of Lords.
That's how absurd it is, right? It's like English peerage. I've got it just because I happen to have a title, for no other reason at all.
Mm-hmm.
We can move people around. I happen to, like many people who are in Congress or senators, I have a home here in Washington, D.C. I've got a house that I own back in Indianapolis, Indiana. I vote in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
But the DNC decided just to move me to Maryland after the election. I guess the theory may be that because the election in Maryland already happened, I'd be less influential in Indiana.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, all of these things are, none of them are important by themselves, but they just show you how crazy the system is. And your question is the right one, the one that most people are not asking, which is, how do we change these rules so that it doesn't happen again?
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is, I believe the answer is pretty simple, is that the person who gets the most votes ought to be the nominee,
mm-hmm.
and the person who gets the most votes ought to then be president of the United States.
There's an obscure book written by a great guy named Thomas Gangalli in California, all about the primary process, a little bit academic, but he lays out in the book many alternate plans, and his is called the American Plan. And to summarize it briefly, he has a series of regional primaries scheduled a month apart, starting in February, and the size of the population of these regional primaries grows over
right.
time. So you start like New Hampshire and Iowa, but without the peculiarities of those two states. And I understand their traditions and their desire to really drive the process, but if we're going to move to the next phase of primary politics, I think we have to get away from the history of those two states and build a program that really identifies key voter groups that are critical to the Democratic Party so that we don't skew it with Iowa and New Hampshire, which, frankly, are not.
Well, all of these different plans are based on the assumption, right, that actual voters' votes count. The reason you want to have a more demographic diversity, for example, is because of the fact that you believe in those states that have higher African-American or have higher Latino populations, their vote will count.
Mm-hmm.
We should begin by changing rules just to make sure that votes count, that people ought to win a state by having simply more votes. The reality is we need delegates to have a party platform, we
mm-hmm.
need delegates to make rules for the party, but we don't need delegates, let alone superdelegates, to actually choose who our nominee is.
Yeah.
We simply ought to have a system that says you get the most votes, you get to be the nominee of the Democratic Party. And that, to contrast that with a Republican system that would not be like that, I think would give the party a great advantage.
Mm-hmm.
No matter, and so instead of focusing just on what order people ought to go in, we also ought to focus on making sure that we actually have people's votes counts in this
yeah.
process. And that's why I think, you know, again, this back to the, unfortunately, the rules that we're stuck with right now, that's the problem we have.
Mm-hmm.
The problem we have is that Joe Andrews is a superdelegate, right?
Yeah.
I'm the problem. And we ought to try to find ways in order to make sure that we're talking about changing the rules
yeah.
so that those of us, you know, who believe the rules ought to be changed can be part of the solution and not the problem.
Joe Andrew with us here on the Tom Hartman program. Now, what about the Great Lakes State? I don't want to forget my Uncle Charlie. He's in his 80s, and he wants to vote. He did vote in the primary, but
right.
he wanted to vote for Obama, and he had to vote for to be named later or something like that.
Well, these,
what do we do with Michigan?
There's no question, obviously. You can't. Again, as a Clinton supporter, I still believe you cannot count the votes in Michigan. It would be absurd to count them since Barack Obama was not even on the ballot there.
Mm-hmm.
And arguments that you should count them, I just are stretch, and no one's going to win this election by stretching. You're going to win this election because you capture the hearts and minds of Americans, and you've got the better policies in place. The challenge on both these things is who pays for it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If you're going to have another election, who pays for it?
And I don't even want to go there, Joe, because the dynamics from January to June, if that's when a rerun
right.
would occur, are so different that it's not fair. It's not representative. And
I don't think
that any kind of these redos make sense in the big scheme of things.
Well, I think the challenge is whether or not you believe that it is important to make sure that the votes count, period, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it does not seem to be fair to say the votes should count on the date that we had the primaries, because obviously the rules were that you could not compete in those primaries.
Right.
So I don't think we can argue that the results of those elections ought to be counted. So if you believe that people's voices ought to be heard and votes ought to be counted, you have no choice but to have an election,
mm-hmm.
period. That actually makes sense.
Yeah.
Republicans argue that they should not pay for it, for example, in Florida, because of the fact that it cost $10 to $18 million.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the very reason they wanted to move their primary up was, of course, the economic benefit of having a primary that matters, because you get thousands of volunteers come in, they go to restaurants, they stay at hotels, they rent cars. Look at all that money we spent
mm-hmm.
at, you know, Dunkin' Donuts that we learned all about from both campaigns.
Right. Joe Andrew, you've written a book called The Blue Way about investing in Is this Democratic or progressive businesses? How do you define blue?
Right. Well, we define blue by giving a majority of money to Democrats or Democratic causes, what the FEC would identify for us as well.
Uh-huh.
And the Freakonomics moment that kind of changed my life in this world is, you know, I spent a lot of my time asking people to give money to Democratic causes and Democratic candidates. And I kept thinking, you know what? I think these businesses that the Democrats run, they're really better companies. They really are.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly when I figured out that if you actually put an investment in those companies, you would have done much better than if you had put investment in the S&P 500. That made a big difference.
Very interesting. It's called The Blue Way, How to Profit by Investing in a Better World. Joe Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Great to meet you.
Great to meet you.
Coming up next, more on the Tom Hartman Program, live from Take Back America in Washington. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We continue on the Tom Hartman Program, live from Take Back America in Washington, D.C. I'm Peter B. Collins, and Jared Bernstein joins us now. He is at the Economic Policy Institute here in Washington, former deputy chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor, and his new book is called Crunch, Why Do I Feel So Squeezed and Other Unsolved Economic Mysteries. Hi, Jared.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to see you again, and very timely here. I need your help. I'm trying to understand subprime, hedge funds, the Bear Stearns meltdown, the calming words from our decider-in-chief, and the late night and weekend actions of the Fed.
Yeah,
explain it all to us.
If you have about 24 hours and some no-dos, we could get right into it. I think the important thing to understand about the subprime slime and the ensuing problems is that the dots can be connected in the following way. We had a remarkable housing bubble in this country where home prices were inflated way, way above both their fundamental value and historical levels. Once that bubble burst, a lot of bad things started happening. First of all, home prices began to fall, and a whole bunch of loans that were really only going to work out if prices kept rising began to default. That's the foreclosure phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, we found that many of those loans were embedded, it's called securitized, were embedded in debt instruments that were held really all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And a firm, an investment firm like Bear Stearns was holding a lot of that bad debt.
Mm-hmm.
The folks who had made those loans were beginning to call in their IOU. So it really was a run on the bank, but in this case a run on an investment bank. And the Fed had to decide, do we let this bank fail, sort of impose the market discipline that should that will happen in that kind of case, or do we get in there and try to orchestrate a bailout because they're too big to fail?
Mm-hmm.
The Fed, working with J.P. Morgan, decided that the bailout was warranted.
Now, the mortgages, the subprimes that were in bad shape, let me just simplify that and call that bad paper, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And from what I understand, there were these different pools of investment, and these securitized mortgages would be sold to people, and the rate of return was based on the rate of risk. So were all the subprime mortgages in one basket?
Mm-hmm.
And has the default, you know, been isolated to a discrete sector? Or did they roll all this up into bigger packages to try to average out the risk, and therefore good paper and bad paper are essentially going down in flames together?
It's really the latter, in the sense that the stuff was all rolled in together. And by the way, let me correct one point you made. Risk was inadequately priced. That's actually one of the problems that got us into this mess. The actual cost, the true cost of the risk that people were undertaking was much lower than it should have been. And part of it, again, connects to the very story you're telling. If you make me a loan, and let's say it's a risky loan, you're going to be worried about whether I'm going to have the capacity to pay back that loan. So you've got a lot of reasons either not to make the loan or to make the loan based on a set of conditions that ensure you get paid back. But how about instead you take that risky loan and you sell it off to somebody far away from you? Now there's this distance between originator, you, and borrower,
right.
me. And that in and of itself has diminished the price of risk, and the stuff all gets bundled up in ways that basically who knows how at this point. And that's why there's so much uncertainty in the markets, because a lot of investors, lenders, don't even know the value of the holdings of many of the people they're dealing with.
So how do we protect working families? I'm not so worried about the chairman of Bear Stearns.
Yeah.
And, you know, I saw in the paper just $922 million in losses. Well, that means he's still got another $400 million left.
Don't worry about him.
But what about the, you know, the people? How is this going to trickle down? The Bush tax cuts haven't trickled down to me yet, but I bet this is going to trickle down faster.
Well, right. I mean, I think the way this works, as far as this is an important question, one that's actually been very underexplored. How does all this, as my grandma would say, mishigas going on Wall Street, affects, you know, working people who are trying to get their kids to school and make the paycheck last through energy and food costs, et cetera. I think the answer is actually somewhat paradoxical, in the sense that by preventing really a meltdown in the financial sector, even though it very aptly can be viewed as bailing out certain bondholders, by preventing a meltdown, the length and depth of the recession can be mitigated. We really do need an economy where credit flows pretty freely. Now, there are ways in which you want to orchestrate these bailouts such that you don't catch too many bad fish in the net, and we can talk about that. But I think the important thing from Main Street's perspective is that the focus is on the Federal Reserve and others getting some of the bad debt off the balance sheet, resolving kind of the crisis in the financial market, the credit markets, so that the economy can start functioning more smoothly again.
Mm-hmm. Jared Bernstein's with us from the Economic Policy Institute. And as we look at this, I heard some rosy predictions about how, you know, by the election time, that this recession may be behind us. Now, the administration hasn't even admitted yet that we're in a recession. The stimulus package doesn't impress me. And I think that this could be a really long one. I think it's dangerous to predict an early recovery. Your comment?
I totally agree with you. There is no way I can imagine that the pain from this recession is going to be gone by Election Day. Remember, the last recession ended and jobs continued to decline for over a year after that.
Yeah.
So it's not just recession, it's recovery you have to worry about.
Jared Bernstein, the new book is called Crunch, Why Do I Feel So Squeezed? Thank you for joining us here.
My pleasure, Peter.
I'm Peter B. Collins for Tom Hartman, live from Washington, D.C., the Take Back America Conference. John Conyers will join us in a few minutes.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
We continue live from Washington, D.C. on the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Coast to Coast. I'm delighted to be sitting in for Tom. Peter B. Collins here at the Take Back America Progressive Conference. And coming up in a few minutes, we're expecting to be joined by Congressman John Conyers of Michigan. And I think we get like 9 minutes with him, and I'd like about 2 hours. I'll certainly ask him about impeachment, but I kind of know what the answer is going to be there. Got to ask him about what to do with Michigan's vote in the primaries. And we also have to get his reaction to Barack Obama's powerful speech in Philadelphia today. Drew Weston joins us now, and I had the pleasure of meeting Drew a couple of months back here in Washington. He is the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. And I was trying to work through you teach at Duke?
Emory,
I'm sorry. This bio, we've got to get a new one. I'm sorry. It hasn't been properly updated. Drew, good to see you again.
Good to see you, too.
Tell me what you think about this speech, Barack Obama under fire. And interestingly enough, I watched the speech on the Fox News channel where the noted expert on American race relations, Bill Kristol, was doing the pre-speech commentary along with a male anchor and a leggy blonde who was not identified on the screen. And I'm not trying to dismiss her, but just what Fox does. The set often, you know, was shown in a wide shot so that we could see that this anchor has really nice legs. But it was an all-white crew there to discuss this important speech on race matters by Senator Obama. And last night, just before I conked out, I caught the end of Hannity and Combs, where Sean Hannity was bragging that he has been playing the Jeremiah Wright clips for a year and 3 months. taking credit for breaking this story. And this is the breathtaking part, Drew. He compared it to the great work he did for the nation in being the first news anchor to feature the Swift Boat veterans in 2004. Now, look at the way that mind works. Ow!
I think I need to put him on my couch.
Sorry, I just intervened on other radio shows. Sorry. It was Fox. Go ahead, Drew.
Well, it's interesting because I watched it on MSNBC, and the pregame warm-up was Pat Buchanan. And a couple of other commentators. One who was superb, but most of them were actually speaking fairly negatively in advance about the speech, about how virtually impossible this is going to be for him to pull off. And I have to say, at the end, other than Pat Buchanan, who basically said, you know, white people of the world unite, everyone was blown away. I mean, I frankly couldn't keep tears out of my eyes through half the speech. It was the most honest speech on race I've ever heard an American deliver. It was the most honest speech on race I've ever heard a Democrat deliver, and it's the speech
and,
on
and
race.
And he was neither defensive nor patronizing.
No.
Those are the two extremes on the meter that I was concerned about.
That's right.
And he did not hit either of those pegs.
No, and you know what was remarkable is that he spoke to black Americans, but he also spoke to those white blue-collar males who defected from the Democratic Party since Lyndon Johnson, and who for the last 30 years have voted less than 40% Democrat, most of the time about 35% Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
But he did it in two ways. One was he basically said, I hear your resentments about things like affirmative action, and they're not all illegitimate,
mm-hmm.
which was a remarkable thing for a Democrat and a black Democrat to say. But the other thing that he did that...
If you can hold that thought, I think we have that clip right now. Chris, let's roll it.
In fact, a similar anger exists within segments of the white community. Most working and middle-class white Americans don't feel that they've been particularly privileged by their race. Their experience is the immigrant experience. As far as they're concerned, no one handed them anything. They built it from scratch. They've worked hard all their lives, many times only to see their jobs shipped overseas or their pensions dumped after a lifetime of labor. They are anxious about their futures, and they feel their dreams slipping away. And in an era of stagnant wages and global competition, opportunity comes to be seen as a zero-sum game in which your dreams come at my expense. So when they are told to bus their children to a school across town, when they hear an African American is getting an advantage in landing a good job or a spot in a good college because of an injustice that they themselves never committed, when their fears about crime in urban neighborhoods are somehow prejudiced, resentment builds over time.
I'm Peter B. Collins here in Washington talking with Drew Weston. Drew, wasn't that an amazing way of explaining those issues and taking the sting of resentment and putting it in an honest context?
It was extraordinary to hear a Democrat speak the truth about race, both sides of the truth. And that was what was so extraordinary about the speech. I think, you know, I was going to say that piece of the speech is something that white, blue-collar males are going to hear, and they're going to hear well, because it's the first time I think I've heard a Democrat ever say that. I can't remember the last time a Democrat said, you know, you work in a mill, I don't care if you're white and you're black, you're not privileged.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the second thing that he did that I think was so important for blue-collar males is that he didn't abandon a friend. He acted like a man. He took this thing, you know,
I can no more disown him than I can my white grandmother.
That's exactly right. And you know what's so powerful about that is that those blue-collar white males, like all of the rest of us, understand loyalty and they understand disloyalty. And had he thrown his own pastor under the bus, it neither would have been honest, nor would anyone have believed it, nor would it have shown courage or loyalty. And I think to say, I'm not going to disown this man who baptized my children, was an act of tremendous courage. And I think it's that's the meta message, the message that most voters will get from it was, my God, this guy's got some cojones to get up there and say that when he could so easily have just thrown him under the bus.
And under fire, he is showing poise, determination, focus, and leadership. Many of the things that the Clinton talking points challenge him on.
Well, you couldn't ask for a better example of leadership. I mean, on the race issue, we haven't heard leadership like that from any Democrat. The last Democrat who came close, ironically, was Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
And the last Democrat who would speak with some honesty about race, about the culture of dependency in our inner cities, was William Jefferson Clinton.
Let's take some calls. We've got listeners who want to talk about this. Sherwin in Seattle, listening to AM 1090, where, in fact, the Peter B. Collins Show is heard on Saturday nights. Hello, Sherwin.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Congressman Conyers. You know, I believe that, you know, I've been following this race since the very beginning before Iowa and all that, and I've kept up close. And I have heard, you know, race throughout this race, particularly when they tried to turn the Hispanic community against the black community. The Hillary Clinton camp tried to do that. And now it's come to this. Race is something that we're gonna we've always dealt with, and we will continue to deal with. But at the same time, by putting Barack in office as the president of the United States, it's going to force the United States to realign its priorities and take a second look at things. It's going to turn a page in history.
Well, Sherwin, I really appreciate your comment. Thank you, sir. Anthony's also in Seattle. Go ahead, Anthony. You're on Air America. I'm Peter B., and he's Drew Weston.
Oh, good morning. I echo the sentiments of the previous caller. It just was amazing how, you know, here, essentially, Barack Obama was being swift-boated with this preacher video that kept getting played on not just Fox, but on CNN. And I actually took it a step further. I got so enraged. You remember the night that Atlanta was hit with that tornado and
right.
it actually struck CNN
yeah.
headquarters?
Yeah.
My local news here in Seattle broke in to their regularly scheduled newscast and brought us breaking news of this tornado in Atlanta. I go to CNN and they're playing the Barack Obama preacher story up, and it just never wavered. And I got so enraged. You know, why are they not reporting the news? You know, I just got so out frustrated. So for him to actually come out and turn this swift boat thing that all of the networks, not just Fox, were playing into this Kennedy or the brother Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy-esque speech, I just thought was fantastic. And for Hillary to not do the same when she had a surrogate that was, you know, Geraldine Ferraro, she just, you know, she took like 28 days or something for her to actually even come to grips with it, where, you know, she says that Obama is not showing a leadership. She's praising John McCain for his leadership. I just think that, you know, today's speech just really settled it for me.
All right, Anthony, thank you very much. Drew, your comment?
Well, two comments. One is, if I didn't live in Atlanta, if I were Jerry Falwell, I would say what happened to CNN was God's wrath on CNN for swift voting. I agree with the caller. I think that you couldn't have asked for a speech that shouted leadership and courage more than this one, when there must have been so many voices calling for him to say, knuckle under, throw the guy under the bus, and move on.
Hey, Chris, can you hold the break for a minute? I'm sorry to do that to you, but I want to take quickly Michael in Long Beach, who disagrees here. Michael, join us on the program, Peter B. and Drew Weston. Go ahead with a quick comment.
Yeah, hi. I just thought Obama, what he's about to pastor, it was slight criticism of the United States. It really troubled me when I hear people saying, yeah, what the pastor said was true. About downgrading the United States and saying that we're a nation of colorblind, that we're not a nation of colorblind. When you see that, when this pastor is saying that the we haven't changed, look at his protege. You don't think that Obama, you think Obama 20 years ago couldn't have run for president. I mean, don't you think that this pastor is blind to the fact that...
Well, Michael, I appreciate your comment. You're breaking up a little bit, but Barack Obama directly addressed that. And he said that Pastor Wright is a creature of the past and is filled with the contradictions of his history, and that he doesn't acknowledge change. And that is one of the things that Obama cited as a difference between him and Jeremiah Wright. I appreciate the disagreement call. Go ahead and roll, Chris. I thank you for holding the break. Drew Weston, thanks for staying with us today. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
And again, Drew Weston's book is called The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of Our Nation. And he teaches at Emory University. We're waiting for Congressman John Conyers. He's been delayed. Celinda Lake, the pollster, will join us next here on the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B. Collins, live from Take Back America, the Progressive Conference in Washington, D.C. More coming up here on Air America.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege.
I'm Peter B. Collins, in for Tom Hartman here at Take Back America. And in just a moment, Congressman John Conyers is going to join us. Things are subject to change here. He just arrived. And Celinda Lake, the pollster, will be joining us probably in the next hour at some point. And while I have a moment, I want to dedicate this broadcast today to my dad. It would have been his 85th birthday, and he was a great man who contributed a lot to me, and I miss him. It's also my friend Rona's birthday. It's a big one with a zero, so happy birthday to Rona Renner. And here comes Congressman Conyers, and he's going to think I'm Tom Hartman, but in fact, I'm Peter B. Collins.
Hello, Peter.
Mr. Conyers, welcome.
You look like Tom Hartman to me.
Please sit down. How are you today, sir?
Of course, I don't look like Harry Belafonte to you.
How are you doing?
Everything's good.
I bring greetings from our friend Tony Truppiano. I understand you visit his restaurant every
My
now
man.
And then.
Oh, God, what a great guy.
Well, he ran for Congress last time in Michigan, too.
Yeah, and he came close.
Uh-huh.
He came very close.
If you can lean into the microphone, there are people all over the country hanging on your every word, sir.
Oh, okay. This is live.
Yes, it is.
And in person.
It is, and I'm delighted to talk with you. First up,
living color.
May I ask you what should happen with Michigan votes in the primaries? Florida has opted out of any kind of a rerun.
Exactly. Well, it's so simple that it's easily overlooked in the political system. Namely, split the votes, don't spend a dime, and get past it. Florida's got over the redo nonsense. Mm-hmm. Michigan soon will follow suit.
Do the delegates get a vote on the first ballot at the convention?
I would imagine they do.
Well, but they're not supposed to be seated under the current rules, Michigan and Florida.
No. Well, once we split the votes, they are seated.
Uh-huh.
It's all over. We just made up. We kissed and made up. And the idea is to do it soon, as early as in front of the convention as humanly possible.
Okay. That's
because we have to go arm in arm, hand in hand. Look. Hillary can't win without Obama and vice versa. And what we're trying to do is not just keep the personality differences down between the two candidates, but between their millions of supporters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my goal. Everybody be nice. This is like the preliminaries. And they're acting like it's the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
The big game is in November. So trying to win this one with desperation and an air of a fanatical must win. Mm-hmm. This is not a sports game.
Did you have a chance to hear or see Senator Obama's Philadelphia speech an hour ago?
It just so happens I happen to have a copy of it here.
I was so impressed. Congressman. He took on the issues without veering into defensiveness, right, without being patronizing to any group that he spoke to. He addressed race head on, both from black and white perspectives, and I really think it was a home run.
I was told to tell everybody on your show, even though you're not Tom Hartman, do the best, that this was the best speech I've ever heard since Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech.
And who asked you to say that?
My staff.
I see.
But I haven't heard the speech.
Okay.
But I got it here, but I haven't read it.
Okay.
And we're trying to get a computer right now so I can hear. I want to hear it.
Oh, you should.
I want to go beyond just reading it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were, look, when staffers are so carried away, look.
He's extending the microphone to a staff person. What's your name, please? What's your name?
My name is Melanie Roussel,
hello,
Communications
Melanie.
Director for the committee.
Uh-huh.
Notice how bashful a communication
she is. I'm shocked. So, Melanie, what was your reaction?
It was the most moving speech I've ever heard live. I was not here for the I Have a Dream speech, but I would say it's by far the most moving speech, and thorough and deliberate.
Yeah.
And
why did you like it? Because
he took every racial emotion and thought and conversation and put it all out on the table,
yeah,
all in 45 minutes.
Yeah.
It was a lot, but
yeah,
it was considerate. I was
moved too.
Moved.
Yeah.
It was the most amazing thing I've
ever
heard.
Thank you, Melanie. Congressman, we just have a minute remaining here, and I want to thank you for your time. Many of my listeners are very concerned about the lack of progress or process on impeachment. And I know you've made the case about why the Democrats aren't pursuing it.
Okay,
but may I ask you?
I'll go back and drop a resolution in as soon as we finish.
Wow. Thank you very much. But would you continue your work at Judiciary, hold them accountable for the U.S. attorney scandal, hold them accountable for the FISA lawbreaking, hold them accountable for the lies we've been told? Will you do that, sir?
We're doing a study on the imperial presidency, so that we'll be
John,
you're listening
thank
to
you very
the Tom
much.
Hartman program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. Tom Hartman program. This is the Tom Hartman program. Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
It's the Tom Hartman program live from Washington, D.C., the annual Take Back America Conference of Progressives. Peter B. Collins here, sitting in for Tom today. You can call into the program. We're taking calls where we can, shifting guests every segment, so things move pretty quickly. But you can dial in toll-free at 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270, and you can drop me an email. It's simple, peter@peterbcollins.com. David J. Sirota joins us now, and I know David from his work at the Center for American Progress a few years ago. He now has a syndicated newspaper column. He's worked for some great progressives like Bernie Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont, and Brian Schweitzer, who is now the governor of Montana. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's good to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you.
Yeah, this is an exciting conference, and the buzz is really strong. The impact of that Obama speech is rippling through this event. We just talked to Congressman Conyers about it. Did you have a chance to catch any of it?
I heard a couple pieces of it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And what's your overall impression of Obama?
Well, you know, I wrote a cover story for The Nation a couple years ago after interviewing him, and my take on him is this, is that here's a guy who wants to do the right thing, who I think wants to be pushed to do the right thing, wants to build a movement that helps him do the right thing if he were to be president. My concern with him is that I think he is conflicted between whether he wants to be a movement leader or wants praise from the highest reaches of the establishment. And it's hard to be both. Mm-hmm. It's almost impossible to be both. In fact, I would defy anybody to name somebody who has been both a movement leader, a successful movement leader, and achieved high praise from the top levels of the bipartisan establishment in Washington with the corollary of while they're alive.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there have been people who've who've led movements who have, after they've died, have been venerated by the establishment. I don't think there's anybody, Dr. Martin Luther King, anybody who has led, you know, Cesar Chavez, you name a movement leader, Paul Wellstone,
mm-hmm.
who has led a movement and simultaneously been embraced by the Washington establishment. And obviously, that's for obvious reasons. If you're mm-hmm. leading a movement against the Washington establishment's not going to embrace you. And so that's my one concern with Obama, is that he's sometimes is a little conflicted on which he wants to be.
Mm-hmm. I'd say one of my concerns is I really, you know, appreciate the rhetoric that he's offered, and this speech today was another one where he was offering a unifying message while being very direct and blunt about the issues of race in this country from both black and white perspectives. And what I have some concern about is this kind of post-partisanship that he offers. It's also embraced by my California governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's hard to govern with. And we saw Bill Clinton trying to unite people after the fractious 92 election, came in with health care and gays in the military as immediate initiatives, and just got slammed right down by Democrats over gays in the military. And I do think that Obama is a realist. I don't think that he's, just a rhetorical wonder. But I think there will be a transition if he's elected to move from the nice idealism of the speech to the hard scrabble world of Washington politics.
Well, I agree with that. And I think that the other part of it is that any time you propose something concrete, it's going to polarize things. I mean, that's just a fact. If you're proposing anything substantive, if you're proposing anything that substantively changes things, you are going to polarize people, because there's going to be a certain segment, maybe not of people, but of interests
yeah.
in Washington that want to preserve the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is look, we don't, look, in an ideal world, I'd love to be in a postpartisan society. I'd love to be in a society where that polarization didn't exist. But throughout our 200-year history, anytime anybody's proposed any change in any substantive way, it has polarized things. And in fact, that's the beauty of democracy, small d democracy. So I definitely, if I have a concern about Obama's postpartisan idea, it's that it will mean that he won't try to do anything. That the only way to really preserve no partisanship mm-hmm. is to not do anything.
Right.
So I guess I worry a little bit about that, mm-hmm. but my hope is that what he's saying is that there is a wide majority of Americans who want to change things, and that represents a post-partisanship over a situation that's presented as polarized here in Washington
mm-hmm.
between
David,
interests.
David Sirota is with us here on the Tom Hartman program. David, in your newspaper columns recently, I have really appreciated your voice speaking for working families on the economic issues that we face. One of the downsides, of course, of the so-called housing bubble and the subprime mortgage problems is that many people over the last 3 to 5 years were using home equity as the financial cushion, as really a savings account, because the equity kept increasing and it was seen as something that you could draw and spend. A lot of people have seen their equities collapse at or below the level of their mortgages, and this combined with the increase in healthcare costs, the 11% increase in food costs in the past year alone, gasoline at $4 a gallon, since we don't raise taxes at the state level, all kinds of fees and higher education tuition have gone up. So there are many hidden tax increases that working families have absorbed during the glorious tax reduction days of the Bush administration. How do we reconcile this, and how do working families navigate the economic mess that we're just heading into?
That's the question of the day. Most polls show that that despite President Bush's rhetoric as a tax cutter, most people believe that their taxes have gone up, and that's not a mistake. Most people's overall burden, financial burden, has gone up. Their local taxes have gone up. Their property taxes have gone up. The federal fees have gone up, and that doesn't even include all the costs that you've talked about that have gone up. I think what people should be most disturbed about heading into this, especially as it relates to housing, is that the government is clearly not operating on behalf of regular people. Here we have a problem of people not being able to afford their mortgages. Ultimately, that is the problem at the center of the financial meltdown, is that there are these what's known as mortgage-backed securities, which are losing their value as people can't pay their mortgages. These securities are based on people paying their mortgages, and when more and more people can't pay their mortgages, the securities that that's based on, those are worthless. Yet here we have a government that looks at that problem and doesn't say, okay, the fix to the problem is to help people pay their mortgages, which will then trickle up to preserve the value of the mortgage-backed securities in Wall Street's hand. Instead, the reaction has been, let's give the banks $200 billion and leave homeowners out to dry. I mean, last week, the Federal Reserve made a decision that was barely covered to issue $200 billion in taxpayer money in exchange for banks giving them ownership of or as collateral for mortgage-backed securities. And as I heard one economist put it, basically what the federal government did was give banks real currency in exchange for counterfeit valueless currency, essentially making the taxpayers be on the hook at the end of the day for those banks' risky and ill-advised loans and investments.
Driven by greed, and I would argue that our investment system and the stock exchange and all of that has slowly been converted from a market to a casino. And through deregulation, particularly the deregulation of banks in the late 1990s, we have this, confluence of various greed interests, and they're not all working for us.
No,
that's
right.
That's where I feel that some significant re-regulation is in order.
And I absolutely agree. And the problem is, here's what the real problem is that you've got Wall Street has given a huge amount of money to both presidential candidates and both parties. And you will notice that while the Democratic candidates, I think, have done a better job of talking about helping homeowners, almost nobody has talked about re-regulation, making sure, for instance, that all of these mortgages cannot be packaged in such complex ways and securitized. What happens is, here's what really happens. When you take, let's say, 10,000 mortgages and you package them into a financial security, right? Basically a bond, if you will, that you then go sell to another investor. The problem is that the more complex you package these mortgages in, the more you bleed the risk into the rest of the economy.
Right.
Pension funds, mutual funds buy these.
Bad paper infects good paper when they're bundled.
Exactly. And so what has happened here is we now not only have a crisis narrowed into one segment, the crisis has, because of deregulation, has been allowed to bleed into the rest of the economy.
David Sirota, a website?
www.davidsirota.com.
Sirota. Good to see you, David.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
Pollster Celinda Lake joins us next, live on the Tom Hartman program from Washington, D.C. I'm Peter B. Collins.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest.
The Tom Hartman Program.
We continue live from Take Back America in Washington, D.C. For Tom Hartman, I'm Peter B. Collins. Tom will be back with you tomorrow. We got the update by sat phone from Nairobi, Kenya yesterday. He is doing well and got out of Darfur safely. He wanted to let us know that. And I'm sure he'll have lots to talk about from that eventful trip when he returns to the air tomorrow. Celinda Lake joins me now. She's president of Lake Research Partners and a progressive pollster. Can you be progressive in a pollster? You're supposed to just do random sampling and not put your finger on the scale, right?
That's right. And we try very hard not to. But then we use those impartial results for very partial ends.
Yeah. Now, you're working on a couple of exciting Senate races, and I want to talk about that. And Herbert in New York is listening, and he's been on hold for a while. He wants to talk about the importance of Senate races this year. Let's pull Herbert up. No, he's on line one. Oh, there we go. Herbert, welcome to the
Hi.
Tom Hartman Program. This is Peter B. with pollster Celinda Lake.
Listen, it takes the 60 for the filibuster, and they've been filibustering the Republicans, just blocking everything the Democrats want to do right now. But there are 23 Republican senators up for re-election. This is the best and this is the only time you have a chance to pick up a lot. However, we're 0 for 17. There are only six that we're competitive in, including Al Franken. And two of them
Franken,
are the Udall brothers. The rest of them, everybody's declined. They are just token people. There's no money invested. Nobody's paying attention to it. This I do not understand.
Now, Herbert, describe the room you're in. Does it have a big board with, like, Senate races drawn all over it?
Yeah, well, sure. We got Alaska. We have two one in Idaho that we could pick up. The Republicans are mad at Craig up there. Everybody knows about that.
The wide stance, yeah.
There are two in Wyoming. Barbara Kubine, who ran, the congresswoman, she almost got beat. She's quitting. She won less by 1,000 votes.
Well, Herbert,
it can be
Herbert,
a Democratic state.
Herbert, hold on here because I want to go to Celinda and ask her for some comments, and I know you're involved in two of these keys.
Go ahead.
All right, Herbert, yeah. Why don't we put Herbert on hold, and we'll come back to him after we've talked a little bit and see if he has any follow-ups because he could be our official Senate race commentator this year. So, Celinda, Begich in Alaska up against Ted Stevens, the
right.
author of The Bridge to Nowhere, and a guy who's been feeding on pork at record levels. He's the king of the earmarks.
He's the king of the earmarks, and he's the king of having people rebuild his own home.
Right.
Lobbyists
yeah.
rebuild his own home. And it's time for a change. I think that Herbert's right. There are a lot of sleeper races, and Herbert mentioned one that I really want to underscore, Idaho. I think that race is not getting enough attention, and I really agree with Herbert. If we don't play in more races, then we're not going to pick up the number of Senate seats. We need some surprises, not just the high-visibility races. Another one that I think is a really strong race is the Noriega race against Cornyn in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Lieutenant Colonel in the National Guard, head of the Katrina effort down there, state legislator, Hispanic, very pro-education. So Herbert's point, we got to broaden this field. We got to have our own surprises.
Yeah.
They always have the midnight surprises on us. We never have the midnight surprises on them. And then, as you mentioned, I'm very excited about the Alaska race. It's dead even now. You have the very popular mayor of Anchorage, and Anchorage is 40% of the electorate
mm-hmm.
in Alaska. So I think there are some real potentials, and not just in places you'd expect us to win races, but in these surprise so-called red states. A lot of red states are going to go purple this election, I think.
Do we need to add purple to the network's color charts?
We do, and Herbert should help us draw that map.
So, Linda, I know you need to go to a panel in a minute or so, but what do you see in your polling as any indicators that progressives and the Democratic Party are going to hold together? There are some real challenges at the seams right now, but what do you see in there about emotions, about attitudes that can help persuade my listeners that the party will stay together and be able to deliver not just the White House, but
right.
a working majority in the Senate and House?
Well, I think, number one, that there is a vote for change. And I think you'll see, a number of candidates. If you're the status quo candidate in this election, you're in trouble, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. I think voters think the economy is virtually in collapse. I mean, 76% of the voters think we're in recession. 59% say we're headed to depression. We need people who are in touch with real people's economic lives. And as you and Dave Sirota and some of the previous speakers were talking about, we don't need to be bailing out banks. We need to be bailing out homeowners. So there's a real populist streak out there, a real opportunity for alternative. And then there are all these new voters who are being mobilized, young people voting at 2.5 times the rate, very solidly Democratic, unmarried Americans voting in record numbers. So we have a real ability to bring change, I think.
Great. Well, Celinda, it's
Thank
always
you.
A pleasure to talk with you. You're working on some great races this year, and I hope they all come up winners.
Me too, with Herbert's help. Thanks
yeah.
a lot.
You head off to your panel, and I'm going to check back with Herbert. Let's put Herbert back up on the line.
Okay.
So, Herbert, what are your thoughts about what you heard from Celinda Lake?
I agree with her wholeheartedly. As a matter of fact, a state like Wyoming could become blue.
Mm-hmm.
And Idaho is a sleeper. And then Kansas. And as she talked about, the one in Texas, is he getting a lot of help? I don't know. What I don't understand, Chuck Schumer is known as the man that twists your arm for a pretzel. And why he's not getting these people out, I can't understand. What's her name? Elizabeth Dole is getting a pass. Lamar Alexander from Tennessee,
mm-hmm.
the guy with the jails. You know,
It's terrible.
All right, Herbert, I've got to run to a break. Will you please
Will
leave
you
your...
Get your people out there and...
Okay, but Herbert, Herbert, I want you to leave your email address with the producer there because I want to stay in touch with you. You know a lot, and I appreciate that. I'm Peter B. Collins, live in Washington, D.C. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America.
Is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
The Tom Hartman Program continues. Tom will be returning tomorrow after his important trip to Darfur. He checked in with us just about this time yesterday on the satellite phone from Nairobi, Kenya, to let us know that he is alive and well. And to explain a little bit about why he hadn't given you definitive locations of where he was in Darfur for their own security reasons. And fortunately, they did not have direct contact with the Janjaweed militia that, of course, is running roughshod over that part of Sudan. I'm Peter B. Collins. We're live at the Take Back America conference in Washington on Radio Row. That's the buzz you hear in the background here. And as you probably know, Vice President Dick Cheney spent the night in Baghdad. They wouldn't tell the press where he slept for security reasons, and he did sally forth from the green zone briefly. He declared that our efforts in Iraq are a successful endeavor that has been well worth the effort. Talking about the security and political landscape changes in Iraq, he used words like phenomenal and remarkable. And he used the opportunity to once again reassert that there was a link between Iraq and al-Qaeda before the U.S. invasion. What planet did that guy come from? Just incredible. And, of course, he was there to soak up the glory of 5 years from the date of the invasion, the shock and awe campaign leading to this grisly occupation that is perhaps the lowest point in recent American history. And there he is once again trying to rewrite history, trying to conflate Iraq and al-Qaeda. And John McCain is over there soaking up the glory as well, preparing to expand his vision of the 100-year occupation. And he talked about al-Qaeda as well. Al-Qaeda is a minor factor in Iraq, but it is played up by the administration, and that is supported by the corporate media in this country, to distort things, and it has led to a kind of relaxation on the part of many that the war is either beyond our control or that things are vaguely getting better and that we should just kind of sit back and worry about the high price of gasoline or something like that. Well, not everybody is taking it that way. Here in Washington, United for Peace and Justice Coalition has a lot of activities planned for tomorrow, the 19th, including an effort to put crime scene tape around the White House. Now, I don't know if they'll be able to do the whole perimeter. That's a pretty interesting kind of action. But they are also featuring a March of the Dead from Arlington National Cemetery into the district and 5 minutes of stillness at Union Station. That is the transit hub near the Capitol. That's going to happen at 5:30 p.m. So lots of activities, and I encourage you to express yourself in the best way you can find. Kari Mosley joins me now here at the Take Back America Conference. He's the regional director and a trainer for the League of Independent Voters / League of Young Voters. And I knew your organization when you started off as the League of Pissed Off Voters. How you doing, Kari?
I'm doing fine.
You still PO'd?
Yeah, we are.
Yeah? What about? What do you got to be PO'd about?
I think we have a lot to be PO'd about, but I think what's more important is that we're taking that energy from being PO'd and we're actually being proactive.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more important to be proactive than just be PO'd, and what we're doing is we're building a new generation of leadership. You know, we're winning on local issues at the local level, and we're swinging elections where young people are the margin of victory.
Yeah, yeah. It is exciting to see. And what are the challenges you're facing? We've had a couple of your colleagues on the program, and when you separate the young people who either are in college or have gone to college from those who don't, their political orientations are different.
Absolutely. The level of engagement, there's a huge disparity. between these two groups when it comes to leveling of engagement. What we find, like you said, when those who have attended college, is a 1 in 4 chance that they voted on Super Tuesday. Those who didn't go to college, there's a 1 in 14 chance that they voted on Super Tuesday.
And what's the reason for that? Are they cynical? Are they just disconnected, hopeless?
I think it's a number of things. Some of the research that went into that talks about how, in many cases, those who didn't go to college come from, you know, poorer school districts, and they don't have civic engagement courses, and they don't have the type of simulations and leadership development, the type of training that we do as the League of Young Voters that provides people from poorer backgrounds, from communities of color. So we see almost a civic education gap in between those who have gone to college and those who haven't gone to college. So they really don't have the same experience of participating in democratic type of activities and procedures.
Do their parents?
And their parents neither. Their parents don't have the same types of experiences. So if you participate in student council elections and go through leadership training programs and things like that, you have an experience in voting and participating in democracy. So when you become a college age adult, you know, you have that experience and you participate in the voting process.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Kari Mosley from the League of Young Voters. You're based in Pittsburgh?
Yes, I'm based in Pittsburgh. Our national office is in Brooklyn, New York.
Uh-huh. And what's your territory?
Our territory, we're in...
No, for you personally.
Me personally, Pennsylvania.
Okay. Now, that's a critical state.
Absolutely.
And we got, 5 weeks until your primary?
Absolutely.
Give us an idea of what you're doing to motivate, activate, and get people out to the polls.
We're doing voter registration. We continue to do voter education programs, registering 17-year-olds as they turn 18 in the high schools. And we have our radios running on local radio telling people that if they want to participate in the primaries, they have to register with a political party before March 24th in the state of Pennsylvania. And we do a lot of other things, like have a poetry slams, parties. We have debate watching events. We've also had watch parties as the numbers come in from the states that voted previously. So we're doing a lot of things to engage people in the political process here in the state of Pennsylvania.
Now, as you've talked to young voters in particular, do any of them raise questions about the pastor of Barack Obama or the pastor of John McCain?
That's actually interesting you asked that. That is so far from the discourse that we hear on the ground with young people. They're not talking about Geraldine Ferraro. They're not talking about Hagee. They're not talking about Jeremiah Wright. What they're talking about is green jobs. You know, they're talking about clean energy. They're talking about gun violence. They're talking about public education. They're talking about the issues. Mm-hmm. And they're really not interested, you know, in the type of political gamesmanship that I think makes for great media and it makes for great political theater. They're really not interested in that. They're trying to figure out which candidate actually is going to speak to their issues and talk about, you know, really how to transform this country over the next 20 or 30 years and make it better than it was for the last 20 or 30.
Yeah, I believe that. I really do. Well, the media storm that's been created, I learned late last night, Sean Hannity takes credit for it. He says that he first started playing Jeremiah Wright clips over a year ago on the Fox News channel, and I have to say, I got my V-chip set up to prevent that Fox from coming in. And so here at the hotel, I saw that, and he compared it and took credit. He said he was also the first who brought us the voices of the Swift Boat veterans who slimed John Kerry. And he linked this Jeremiah Wright sequence to that. I think it's very telling. But let's listen to a portion of the speech that Senator Obama gave in Philadelphia across the street from Constitution Hall this morning, because here he asks and answers his own questions about what he knew about Jeremiah Wright and the sermons that he was giving at the Trinity Church in Chicago. Let's listen.
Did I know him to be an occasionally fierce critic of American domestic and foreign policy? Of course. Did I ever hear him make remarks that could be considered controversial while I sat in the church? Yes. Did I strongly disagree with many of his political views? Absolutely. Just as I'm sure many of you have heard remarks from your pastors, priests, or rabbis with which you strongly disagree. But the remarks that have caused this recent firestorm weren't simply controversial. They weren't simply a religious leader's efforts to speak out against perceived injustice. Instead, they expressed a profoundly distorted view of this country, a view that sees white racism as endemic, that elevates what is wrong with America above all that we know is right with America. a view that sees the conflicts in the Middle East as rooted primarily in the actions of stalwart allies like Israel, instead of emanating from the perverse and hateful ideologies of radical Islam. As such, Reverend Wright's comments were not only wrong, but divisive. Divisive at a time when we need unity.
Now, Kari Mosley, what's your reaction? My background is I was raised a Catholic, and I can tell you that there are many sermons that I've heard in Catholic churches that wouldn't play well if they were soundbited and strewn on the media every 20 minutes. What's your reaction? I don't know your religious background, if any, but what's your sense of what Senator Obama said trying to explain the Black Liberation theology tradition to average Americans?
I think he's absolutely right. You know, my mother is part of the AME church, and I spent a lot of time in that church as well as I spent a lot of time in African-American Baptist churches. And there's definitely been times when issues such as homosexuality come up in the pulpit. And the pastor, many of whom I respect deeply, say things that I disagree with in totality.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it's very important that we in some way separate what happens in the pulpit from, you know, what happens, you know, on the political campaign trail.
Well, and to respect that one can attend a religious service, can hear a point of view expressed, can, you know, import that into your system, analyze it, and make good choices about what you embrace and what you don't. The church I used to go to, is opposite me on so many issues about abortion, about contraception, about, you know, just so many other social justice matters. And yet I can talk to Catholics and I can listen to a Catholic priest and sift out for myself what I want and what I reject.
Absolutely. I agree totally. You know, I would hate for someone to see me, in a church where a preacher was expressing their views about homosexuality and then try to say that that's the same way I felt because I was in the church that day.
Yeah.
I would really be concerned about that.
Kari Mosley, keep on working in Pennsylvania. Thanks for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
Peter B. Collins for Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day.
5 days a week.
The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege.
That's the voice of Tom Hartman. He'll return tomorrow to his program. I'm Peter B. Collins, delighted to be sitting in again for Tom, live from the Take Back America conference. And there goes John Conyers again. Thank you, Congressman.
Oh, wow.
And Donna Edwards, who will be joining him in the Congress next year. What do you want to say about Donna Edwards, Congressman?
Are we on air now?
Yes, this is live.
Should I keep the secret about us, Donna?
No, go ahead. You tell what you want.
I don't want to prejudice her arrival in the Congress, so I'll keep it a secret, but this is one sharp woman intellectually and courageously. She is on the case, and we are looking forward to her coming in on the 111th Congress.
All right.
Can we get her a seat on Judiciary?
She says she didn't want to go on Judiciary because I'm the chairman.
But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now, is that true? That doesn't sound accurate. Donna Edwards. Donna Edwards, by the way, we should reintroduce. She was on with us yesterday, got interrupted by Tom Hartman's call, and today she got big-footed by John Conyers. Welcome back, Donna.
That's all right. I'm all right to be big-footed like that any day.
Yeah.
It's great to be here.
What committee do you want to be on when you get to Congress?
Well, you know, I really care about health care for people in my congressional district and across the country. And so I want to try to be on a committee that, you know, deals with health care.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Ways and Means does a mighty powerful committee. The incumbent Congressman Wynn is stepping down for Energy and Commerce, and they also deal with health care and telecommunications,
mm-hmm.
and environmental policy, a lot of the things that I care deeply about.
Well, and when you get to Congress, you'll have health care, and they can work on your voice. And that throat lozenge I just gave you, that would be $952 if you're not insured.
You know, that's the thing, and I once went without health care insurance, and so I get worried about people out in our congressional district who would be people like me.
Yeah.
Who are really challenged by the system that we we have, but I'm still hoping that my congressional salary will allow me to buy an occasional cough drop.
Good. And did you lose your voice at that the gathering you had last night, the reception here?
Well, it's a combination of things, because here at Take Back America, I mean, it's just such a wonderful gathering of progressives from around the country. And, you know, it means it's about, you know, almost 72 hours of nonstop talking.
Right, yeah. Well, it's great to have you here, and thank you for being patient yesterday, because we were talking when Tom Hartman called in from Nairobi. I wanted to get your reaction to Senator Obama's speech in Philadelphia this morning. And here is a powerful excerpt from it where he offers some thoughts about recent comments and the situation that he has, where they're essentially asking him to disown Reverend Wright. And let's listen to what he had to say here. It's powerful.
I can no more disown him than I can disown my white grandmother, a woman who helped raise me, a woman who sacrificed again and again for me, a woman who loves me as much as she loves anything in this world, but a woman who once confessed her fear of black men who passed her by on the street, and who on more than one occasion has uttered racial or ethnic stereotypes that made me cringe. These people are part of me, and they are part of America, this country that I love.
So that is an incredible statement, where in dealing with Reverend Jeremiah Wright, he linked it to not rejecting his own white grandmother, and to talk about how these are a part of him, his DNA, essentially. I just think that it's amazing how he responded to this without being defensive and without being preachy.
Well, I think it was one of the most powerful speeches that I've ever heard. I think, you know, Senator Obama had a choice. He could have taken the safe route and disowned, you know, disassociated himself from Reverend Wright, and then moved on over this little hurdle, bump in the road. And he didn't do that. He chose the courageous route. And the courageous route, by talking about all of us, each of us, as part of a bigger family. And we know that in each of our families we have these kinds of challenges. And I think that Barack Obama, at a place and in a time, is exactly the right messenger we need in this time and in this place to carry on this conversation about the dualities of race in this country. And he said that we all have work to do. As African Americans, we have work to do in our own families and our own communities.
Yeah.
As white Americans, we have work to do. As Hispanics and Asians, we have work to do. And we have work to do collectively as Americans.
And so
I couldn't have thought of a better speech.
And as a great speechwriter and deliverer, he framed it around the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, which, of course, came out of Philadelphia right across the street from where he was speaking. And it began with we the people to form a more perfect union. And he said our union isn't perfect, but we must keep working toward perfection.
Well, you know, I thought about my own life in that speech. You know, my grandfather and my father served in the United States military, and they served honorably. But they also served in a segregated armed forces, but they still loved their country. And I think each of us as Americans can look back on our history, as Senator Obama has done, and said, you know what? There's a part of our family and our family history that's not really pretty, but we need to move on collectively. And so I just, again, not a more powerful messenger who could have brought that message to us as an American people.
Yeah. And in your own life and in your own run for Congress, how do you see race playing into it, and has it been a factor, positive or negative?
Well, you know, when I ran for Congress in 2006 and I lost just narrowly to the incumbent congressman, I ran very, very strongly in the predominantly white areas of my congressional district. About a third of our district is white. And I won almost 70% of the vote there. And I only won about 40% of the vote in the black community. And as an African-American woman, it touched me deeply, because I would hear things like, I'm not black enough, that I don't really get black communities. And I had to go beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it plays out, but we get over it.
Yeah.
We get over it.
Donna Edwards, thank you very much for joining us. Great to see you again. Take care of your voice and avoid the stairwells.
Thank you.
She got trapped in a stairwell earlier this morning here at the hotel. Live from Washington, we'll continue on the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Thank you.
The Tom Hartman Program, for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman. Zone with Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome to another hour of the Tom Hartman Program, originating from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. I'm subbing for Tom again today, Peter B. Collins from San Francisco, and I am delighted to be joined by Norman Lear, the super producer and a very important progressive activist.
Who is in turn delighted to be here.
Yeah, well, good. Founder of People for the American Way, people remember you for producing sitcoms like All in the Family and many other great programs over the years. But I also honor you for the way you helped bring attention to the Declaration of Independence. You financed the exhibition of a copy of the Declaration of Independence that
printed
traveled
the night of July 4, 1776, before it was signed, which took place some months later.
Mm-hmm.
This is this piece of paper, the country's birth certificate, born that night. So it's been traveling to colleges, campuses, museums, and mm-hmm. city halls everywhere across the country.
A couple of years ago, we started a progressive talk station in Monterey, California. And in that interim period before we had everything working and on the air, we played a loop of the Declaration of Independence sung by the Fifth Dimension. Have you ever heard that?
Oh, I've heard that. It's wonderful.
And people did not recognize it. And they called up and said, what is this sedition?
Have you seen the reading of the Declaration of Independence, or heard it, the Declaration by Mel Gibson, Michael Douglas, Renee Zellweger, 11 major figures who traveled to Philadelphia and in the Independence Hall, working all night one night after the crowds had gone, where the Declaration was conceived?
Yeah.
They did a reading of it that was photographed, and it's exquisite.
And Senator Obama gave a speech today in Philadelphia, across the street, he said, from Constitution Hall, and he framed his speech about race around the elements of the Declaration to form a more perfect union. What did you think of the speech, Norman Lear?
I thought the speech filled the moment, and the moment in history is huge. It goes to race, it goes to economics, it goes to everything, it goes to wars. Not that he mentioned each of those things, but because it went to the essence of the human condition,
mm-hmm.
it filled the space. I thought there was the educator in addition to the leader we need.
Now, Norman Lear, you're a great judge of performing talent. I'm not calling Barack Obama an actor, but his performance as a speaker, his performance as a candidate, has greatly impressed me. How about you?
Well, if a camera were on me now, I hope I would be generating the same feeling, because I'm speaking from my heart. And when you get that in anybody, there's something different going on.
Yeah.
And I think he was speaking from beneath the soles of his feet to the world.
Now, tonight, you're going to be honored here at the Take Back America Conference as the Lifetime Leadership Award winner, and it's going to be presented by Bill Moyers. Now, that's really touching.
Bill Moyers, to whom every American owes the most enormous debt for what he's able to do every Friday night on PBS.
Well, and he's done, won't single out any particular program, but on the war in Iraq, on our civil rights, on the rights of detainees, he has done incredible work. And he's been fighting, of course, the Bush administration's efforts to shut him down. We know about mm-hmm. Ken Tomlinson, who is running the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And he had a very political agenda, forced Tucker Carlson onto PBS in some cockamamie idea of balancing Bill Moyers.
Mm-hmm. And an ally in all of this for 25 years now has been People for the American Way.
PFAW. And sitting next to you is Catherine. Is it Colbert or Colbert?
Colbert.
Okay. Only Stephen gets the Colbert.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
We're going to battle it out there for the correct pronunciation.
Well, Catherine, welcome.
Thank you.
And
great to be here.
You told me just seconds ago that you've been a People for the American Way for a week now?
Oh, no, just 2 days. Today's my second day. I started yesterday morning, and I'm thrilled to be here. We have an ambitious agenda ahead of us over the next year and a half until the certainly before the election, and I am thrilled to be part of it.
Now, Norman, did you fully vet her, and did you check what her preacher said before you offered her this position?
We had her preacher in.
Oh, you had her preacher in?
The preacher came in and talked to us for 2 days. So we know everything there is to know about Kitty Colbert, especially the case she pled before the Supreme Court and won for the women of America.
Well, tell me about that.
Well, I had the great opportunity to argue Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which was the 1992 case that at least partially reaffirmed Roe versus Wade.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons I bring such passion to this job, is because I'm so fearful that the current Supreme Court is going to take away many of the rights that all of us take for granted.
Mm-hmm.
The rights to choose, the right to religious tolerance, the right to equality, rights that the First Amendment, the court just took a new case yesterday involving the First Amendment, which could seriously jeopardize what we, the protections that we all take for granted.
And I'm torn on that one because it's about fleeting obscenities, and I don't think that's an area that we should be worrying about, but it also deals with Fox. Fox is the potential victim of a negative Supreme Court ruling there, so that's it's hard to choose sides there.
Well, yes, but, you know, the thing about free speech is you really can't look at who's saying it when the case comes to the court.
Right.
You got to look at the principle behind it. And, you know, People for the American Way and all of us have long believed that free speech is so essential to our democracy that it needs to be preserved at all costs.
Well, and it's just been tragic because the way the FCC has been converted into a kind of morality police, the Janet Jackson, it was 1/16th of a second. Nobody actually saw it, but because you could have, that became such a cause célèbre. And now somebody like me could be fined $350,000 for something that I said, or even possibly an obscenity uttered by Norman Lear right here on this program. They would fine me for allowing that to be broadcast. And that's a chilling challenge to our free speech rights.
I thought when I, as I remember the Janet Jackson incident, it was in the middle of a
Super
major
Bowl.
Super Bowl appearance, cost hundreds of thousands, if not a couple of million dollars. And all of it produced for some degree of, it was slutty.
Yeah.
The whole experience was costing all of that money, paid for, as is all of American television, by the corporations that by that time. So the real place to look for, you know, if you want to deal with that, are the people who are buying it, not the incidental performers or writers or who are making a living delivering the supply for the demand of the people who buy.
Yeah, that's Norman Lear along with Kitty Colbert. She is the new president of People for the American Way. And if you could tick off three important things you want to work on, what's your agenda?
Well, my first and foremost agenda is making the Supreme Court an issue in this next election.
Please.
More than the presidency is on the line here. Whoever is our next president will appoint at least one, maybe three new Supreme Court justices. We are on the brink of being overtaken by ultra-conservative justices on that court, and all of the rights that we take for granted are up for grabs.
I agree.
The presidency makes a big difference for the next 30 years on the Supreme Court, and the Senate makes a huge difference over the next 30 years. So we are working very, very hard to make that an issue in the 2008 election.
And Kitty, can I ask you to take another look at election reform issues? I did not support Rush Holt's bill, H.R. 811, last year, and People for the American Way did. And I'd like you to take a fresh look at that, because it was in a, it didn't pass, but it could have locked in the electronic voting system that I think is a big mess in this country. And we've seen that a return to paper ballots, hand-counted, is a more credible way to conduct elections.
Well, you know, I think we need to take a look at all of the election reform issues, because my view is we need universal voting, lifetime voting. It is a, it's an, you can get a driver's license, and it lasts for 20 years. You should be able to get a voter registration that lasts for your lifetime. You know, many of the barriers that we take for granted are unnecessary, and I absolutely think we need to look for how we can broaden the right to vote to be inclusive of every American.
Great.
And that will be on our agenda for
I'll be happy to work with you on that. That's Catherine Colbert. She is the new president of People for the American Way. Its founder, Norman Lear, here with us. Thank you, Norman. Great to see you.
Thank you. I couldn't have enjoyed it more.
Congratulations on your honor. I'll look forward to the presentation tonight. I'm Peter B. Collins, live from Washington, D.C. We'll continue on the Tom Hartman Program here at Take Back America.
Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day.
5 days a week.
We're on the Tom Hartman Program, live from Take Back America in Washington, D.C. This event is produced by the Campaign for America's Future, and their website is ourfuture.org. If you log on there, there are live blogs and dead blogs and recent blogs and some video stuff and Rick Perlstein's ravings, all kinds of stuff. And the guy who's riding herd all over the over all of this is Robert Borisage. Bob, welcome to our program.
My pleasure. I think riding herd maybe under the herd.
Well, can you do something about those bloggers next door? They are so noisy with those laptops.
Right.
It's just deafening.
75 bloggers here at this conference.
Yeah. So. Well, it's terrific. And this is really building. And, of course, with the important election cycle underway, the buzz here is terrific. And, you know, despite some of the tensions we've seen between the campaigns, I'm finding all the people I talk to really have the best interests of the country and secondarily the party in mind to move forward and to, you know, really focus on the big contest, which is to defeat the Republicans, and also not just to solely focus on the presidential race, because we need to get a working, get close to 60 or maybe more than 60 votes in the Senate. Can I dare dream of that, Bob?
Well, I tell you, we had a press conference this afternoon with the array of organizations that are organizing the largest progressive mobilization, registration of voters, education and mobilization to get out the vote. And the woman from MoveOn.org announced that they were targeting a special program to elect 60 Democratic senators to erase the ability of Republicans to obstruct the agenda.
Well, that's really important. And you sounded some themes in your keynote yesterday morning that I think are important for people to hear. Because you talked about how progressives are very significant, crucial, in this year's campaigns. But that the work doesn't end after the November election. And that we will have a job in the next ongoing, to really press progressive issues and viewpoints and make sure that those that we elect don't forget who brought them there and what their marching orders are.
Yeah, exactly. We have to build an independent progressive movement. It may find its vehicle through the Democratic Party, but we have to hold politicians accountable, whatever party they're in. And I think progressives discovered that after 2006 when they elected Democratic majorities in both houses and thought they would bring the war to an end and were disappointed when they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of what our project has to be is not simply driving issues in the debate, not simply mobilizing voters to get out the vote and to make sure that the right people get elected, but then an accountability project where we organize independently to hold politicians accountable. We kicked off the conference this week with Donna Edwards, who has just beaten Al Wynn, who is an 8-term incumbent Democrat in Prince George's County, who had started really to serve as contributors and not as constituents and had been for the war. And so we got a progressive champion to challenge him in a primary, and she beat him. And that was a good object lesson, I think, for the rest of the party.
Right. Now, you helped Reverend Jesse Jackson when he was running for president. What does the Rainbow Coalition have to offer us as a model going forward for progressive activism that links to the Democratic Party at election time, but has sufficient independence not to be co-opted or wedged in?
Right. I mean, we had a panel this morning with Reverend Jackson and Roger Wilkins and Taylor Branch talking about King and Johnson during the Civil Rights era, and the tension and the importance of an independent movement pushing the president to do what he wanted to do but couldn't get done, didn't think he could get done unless they made him do it, right? So it took the Selma March to get the Voting Rights Act passed, and Johnson realized that. I mean, Taylor Branch related a conversation Johnson had with King where he said, "You made me do this, and I appreciate that."
Mm-hmm.
And then they went on to argue about the war because they were then... They had been unified on one thing with King pushing, but then they were, you know, at loggerheads on the war.
And on that note, I recommend anytime someone is in Austin, Texas, you go to the LBJ Library because he taped those phone calls,
right,
and you can hear them. And to hear his big Southern drawl and to hear Dr. King's voice on the other line is just priceless.
Yeah, and the lesson is priceless, which is we have got to... mobilize independent energy around the issues of changing the course of this country and the direction of the country, and we've got to ensure that when we elect somebody, they carry that agenda to office, and then we hold them accountable to it, that you're not allowed to go south, and if you go south on too many issues, we're going to challenge you in primaries, you're going to have some trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can learn that lesson, staying mobilized, I think this election could be a defining election. This is an election, we just released a report on comparing it to 1980 as a sea change election.
Mm-hmm.
Where there's a sufficient ideological divide between the two parties. There's a fundamental crisis in the country at home and abroad. You have a population that's ready for dramatic change.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can continue to expand the agenda and to push people and to elect real champions and then to hold them accountable, I think we can really change the course of the country.
And do you have a vision if the Reagan election in 1980 was a sea change? Can a Democratic sea change last longer than one or two terms and really unravel the damage of the wrecking crew of the Bush administration and rebuild our domestic and foreign policies?
Right. It has to last more than one or two terms if you're going to undo the damage and build the new direction. You can imagine what the next president is going to face when he or she gets into office in January. You're going to have an economy that will be in the pit, in a very serious recession.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have a war that will have continued and with now 35,000 casualties. They're going to have to really keep moving, and it's going to take a long time to rebuild out of that hole.
Bob Borisage, Executive Director of the Campaign for America's Future, thanks for joining us, and thanks for this event. Good to see you. We'll continue on the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Tom Hartman Program, live from Washington, D.C. at the Take Back America Conference. A lot of activity here, quite a buzz. Coming up in a few minutes, we're going to talk with a representative of the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union. They have been front and center doing great work, particularly on the FISA law and the illegal wiretapping of American citizens. So we'll talk about that shortly. Joining me now is John Gorenfeld. He's got a new book out called Bad Moon Rising, and we are trying to fight subtitle creep, but I'm going to read it anyway. Subtitles are getting longer and longer, John.
They are.
How Reverend Moon Created the Washington Times, Seduced the Religious Right, and Built an American Kingdom. And I think that Reverend Moon is a figure who gets too little attention in this country. And some of his efforts, including the Washington Times newspaper, are treated as if they're part of the media establishment in this country. Tell us a little bit about the Washington Times. Moon has invested or subsidized it to the tune of over $1 billion, hasn't he?
Close to $3 billion,
no.
Actually. Since 1982, it has never made a dime. This is a massive money-losing gift to the right. And I think it's a sign of how crazy and amoral Washington, D.C. can get, that conservatives feel it's completely acceptable to work with this man who, in the 70s, as a lot of people listening will remember, Weaver was considered a dangerous madman on the order of Jim Jones, Charles Manson, or L. Ron Hubbard. This is the guy who is leader of the Moonies, best remembered for the mass weddings where they would marry thousands of strangers to people chosen for them by Reverend Moon. And over the next 20, 30 years, starting under the Nixon administration, the Reverend Moon and his church, the Unification Church, made a concerted effort to make a place for themselves in Washington, D.C.
Well, and they've wriggled in. I remember a story a few years ago. I haven't had a chance to read your book yet, John, and maybe you cover this, but the city paper here, the free weekly paper in Washington, had an extensive report on Reverend Moon's holdings, including a fresh fish wholesale distribution company that apparently has, you know, muscled in and controls a lot of the fish distribution here on the East Coast. I had sushi last night. Was that a Moon product?
Well, if you look for the True World Foods logo, Reverend Moon, as the Chicago Tribune discovered a couple of years ago in a big report, has monopolized the sushi industry in the United States. His company, True World Foods, supplies the majority of sushi chefs in America at the levels between fishing, distributing. In fact, he calls himself the Ocean King because of this plan that he's put into effect so successfully to monopolize sushi.
So you think I ought to swear off sushi so I don't have to indirectly support Reverend Moon?
You could at least swear off the Washington Times. Yeah, the sushi is definitely a large part of his income, but so is, oddly enough, shamelessly conservatives have taken money from this man who has been in trouble in the courts in Japan for ripping off widows with an incredibly ambitious swindle that lasted throughout the 90s. A time when George H.W. Bush actually went on tour with the Reverend Moon to Japan to help him avoid getting his church kicked out of Japan. Large numbers of huge amounts of money have been streamed into the Washington Times from this swindle of old ladies in Tokyo. The idea was that they would come to your house and scare women who had lost a husband into thinking that their late husbands would go to hell unless they gave huge amounts of money to the Unification Church.
And some of that money has been brought in by human couriers. Isn't that the case? Haven't they busted some people with suitcases of cash?
Well, that's always the suspicion. There's a large theme of money laundering winding through the book. And in fact, in Uruguay, people there were very concerned and were complaining that millions and millions of dollars were being laundered through a bank over there from unclear origins. Mm-hmm. And Moon himself, of course, has been busted for tax evasion. There's a lot of very mysterious money flowing around conservative Washington that's associated with Reverend Moon.
John Gorenfeld is with us. His new book is called Bad Moon Rising. Did you have to pay credence to get that title?
No, actually the marketing department came up with that one.
It's from Polypoint Books, right?
Yeah.
And it's out in hardcover right now. What about the relationship between the Bush family and Reverend Moon and the Unification Church?
Well, one of the strangest things I discovered in writing about this is that the Bush family seems to have taken it upon themselves to keep the money flowing to the Washington Times by going on tour from time to time with Reverend Moon, stroking his ego as the Messiah. And Bush Sr., for example, went to Buenos Aires. Reuters reported around 1995-96. Showed up, and as Moon was in trouble, possibly with the new government, with the government there that was upset that he was founding a new academy, Bush acted as a paid spokesman to the tune of at least $1 million for Reverend Moon, and showed up and said, "This is the man with the vision whose paper restores sanity to Washington D.C." That's actually a direct quote. Also toward Japan, with Mrs. Moon. And the younger Bush has taken a huge amount of money from the Unification Church as well. When he was re-inaugurated, he accepted a $250,000 gift from the business interests of the Unification Church. A lot of money going around. And most recently, and most weirdly, is that Neil Bush, the corrupt younger brother of George W. Bush, for a couple of years now has been showing up in international news reports, going on tour with the Reverend Moon Roadshow, appearing most recently in Paraguay, where Reverend Moon owns over 1 million acres of property. And, of course, Neil Bush was a welcome presence in helping to reassure the local officials that Reverend Moon was a good guy who should be allowed to own all of this property down there.
Well, there is a story that I've only been able to trace to the Cuban news service. It surfaced about a year and a half ago, that one of the president's daughters bought a 97,000-acre ranch in Paraguay. I've never been able to confirm it from another source, but I find that interesting.
This was a major rumor in the Latin American press, actually not just Cuba, but in Argentina and other places. That one is hard to confirm. It was all over the place that the Bush family was involved in purchasing this large ranch down there. I haven't been able to confirm that one. It's pretty much just rumor and hearsay from Latin American officials, some of whom will swear by it, though.
Yeah, John Gorenfeld with us, the author of Bad Moon Rising about Reverend Moon. Now, I have followed him from California since the 1970s. There's a ranch they used to, maybe it's still there in Boonville, where they used to recruit people off the streets of San Francisco, young homeless or aimless people, and take them up
college
there
students,
and brainwash them into joining the Unification Church and then going out and selling flowers and recruiting more people behind them. And I'm curious, one of the things that Moon has offered as his theology is that he's the Messiah. And that he is here to bring together all the religions of the world. Now, how does the religious right deal with this? I have never heard a pastor in this country, a Christian, openly criticize Reverend Moon for his theological posing.
No, it's actually something that most Christians should find incredibly shocking. And it really is ironic that conservatives, as we know from the Obama pastor thing that's gotten so much attention over the last few days, there are these constant accusations of heresy. But what Reverend Moon preaches is not just that he is the second coming, but that the first coming, Jesus, was a failure and turned in substandard work as a bad contractor. The Reverend Moon preaches that because Jesus failed in his mission, in fact, there's a large anti-Semitic component to this, that he blames the Jews and says that the Holocaust was God's punishment for preventing Jesus's mission. He claims that he's here to complete the mission, and in his description of it, the mission is to achieve political power in Rome. Rome is the United States in Moon's teaching, and that Jesus's contribution, according to Moon, was worth nothing because of his failure. And he's so committed to this idea that Jesus was a failure that in 2003, while nobody was really paying attention, Reverend Moon staged an ambitious tear down the cross tour. There are photographs and all sorts of boasts about this from the Moonies, who are very excited about it. They even held a funeral for the Christian cross in Jerusalem that I talk about in my book. They put on this ceremony where they dug a shallow grave in Potter's Field in Jerusalem and put a cross there and put Reverend Moon's flag on top of it and said, that's it. And we're repenting for the false faith of 1,700 years, which was Christianity. And for religious right conservatives to have worked with this guy so closely for the last two or three decades is really a scandal. And what I discover in my book is that lots of major operators on the religious right over the years have compromised their Christianity and their family values, ethics to work with this guy, considering that he's best known for ruining a whole lot of people's lives in the 70s. People wake up one day and discover that their daughter has disappeared and she's with the Unification Church, and they chase down rumors and they hire a private eye and they finally find their daughter. This is a true story that's in my book, at a dormitory on Long Island, and she's been brainwashed and she's refusing to talk to them. Well, you know, then they look further and they find out that the president of the United States, George H.W. Bush, is on tour with this guy. And so it's this breathtaking sort of hypocrisy.
I know a lawyer in California named Ford Green who has specialized in springing people from the Moonies, and part of it is called deprogramming. They have to get them and work with them with psychologists to undo the coercive persuasion that has been applied to them. Let's talk to Bob in Hollywood. Bob's got a comment for us. Oh, looks like the call dropped. Sorry, Bob. Call us back and we'll try to squeeze you in if we can. One of the other things, John Gorenfeld, that fascinates me is at least the early connections between Reverend Moon and the Korean Central Intelligence Agency. For the longest time, his top lieutenant was Colonel Bo-hee Pak, P-A-K. And Colonel Pak had that title because he got it from his work at the Central Intelligence Agency in Korea. And when Reverend Moon first started to defend Richard Nixon, we saw the outlines of a kind of collusion between the security state of Korea and the security state of the United States. Does that linger to this day?
I'm not sure what the Korean CIA connection is to this day, but it was a major influence peddling scandal that barely anyone remembers that was a subject of a Capitol Hill probe that Moon was an agent of influence. This is on the front page of the New York Times.
John Gorenfeld, Bad Moon Rising. I'm Peter B. Collins here on the Tom Hartman Program, live from Washington, D.C.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege.
That's Tom Hartman. This is his program. Tom returns tomorrow after his important trip to Darfur. We heard from him yesterday at the airport in Nairobi, and he is winging his way back to Portland. He expects to arrive about midnight local time tonight, and we'll be back live on the program tomorrow. I'm Peter B. Collins. My website's peterbcollins.com. You want to find out more about me? We're joined by Jesselyn McCurdy, a legislative counsel here in Washington at the American Civil Liberties Union. Welcome. How are you, Jesselyn?
Fine. Thank you for having me, Peter.
One of the things that I know you've been working on, we've actually seen some progress in recently. It started with the National Sentencing Commission, and then the Congress passed some legislation which has sharply changed the draconian laws that Joe Biden helped author after Len Bias died back in the 80s.
That's right.
That created this 100-to-1 difference between sentencing for crack cocaine and powder cocaine. Most people are familiar that crack convicts are generally African-American and inner city, and that powder cocaine, people convicted of use of possession of that, are typically suburban whites.
Absolutely.
And we also, when you mix those together with the ugly chemistry of minimum mandatory sentences that tie the hands of judges, and then you see people who are bit players, the girlfriend, the guy at the gas station who answered the phone, who get drawn into these criminal conspiracy trials and end up being handed huge sentences because of what I just described.
Mm-hmm.
We've had huge injustices in this country. How many convicts do you believe have been unjustly sentenced behind these crack laws who are currently serving terms?
Actually, what we know is right now there are 19,500 people who have been convicted of crack cocaine offenses who would be eligible for a change in their sentence based on the Sentencing Commission's decision in December of 2007. And so that's a significant number of people in one context, but in the other context we're talking about 600,000 people a year are released from prison. So in that context it's a very small number. And the 19,500 people who are eligible to have their sentence reviewed would have their sentence reviewed over 30 years. So, you know, there was kind of a campaign by Attorney General Mukasey to paint this as a bunch of violent criminals are going to be coming out of prison. Well, that's just not true. There, at most, will only be 2,200 people who will be eligible to have their sentence reduced under the new guidelines of the Sentencing Commission. Many of them will not have their sentence reduced, depending on what type of crime they committed. And all of them will have served their mandatory sentence, 5, 10, 15, some cases 20 years in prison before they're even eligible to be resentenced.
Now, does either the work of the Sentencing Commission or the legislation address the inequities of these bit players I referred to?
The Sentencing Commission, the work of the Sentencing Commission does not, and that's why it's so important for Congress to act. Congress still needs to act.
It's passed the House, is that right?
It has not passed the House.
There were hearings
in both the Senate and the House in last month on this issue. We're hoping that a bill will soon be discussed in the Senate, particularly. That seems like where there's some movement. But really, the Supreme Court, as you mentioned also, the Supreme Court addressed this issue back in December and handed down a decision in the Kimbrough case, which said that judges now, under the new decision, the Booker decision, decision can sentence people below the sentencing guidelines in these crack cocaine offenses if they disagree with the policy of 100-to-1.
And the technical term for that is a downward departure.
Is a downward departure in sentencing. And so that was, I mean, in this particular, with this particular Supreme Court, that was a 7-to-2 decision. Even these judges on the Supreme Court that obviously are very conservative, mm-hmm. particularly on criminal justice issues, recognize the unfairness that is built in to both, I think, the mandatory minimum structure of sentencing, right. as well as the sentencing guidelines.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is, I think, an important sea change, because since the 1980s, we have simply ratcheted up laws. We have zero tolerance for this and zero tolerance for that. And a lot of it is nonsensical. It may make people feel good at the time or help somebody win an election. But when you actually try to rationalize the penalties for various crimes, it's all haywire.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in California, if you're a third striker, you can get 25 years for stealing a bicycle, and it happened. And that's not what the intent of the voters was, even though I think they were misguided in passing it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So do you see any broad softening in this draconian approach? Are we ready, for example, to reduce minimum mandatories in other criminal categories?
I do. I think particularly on the state level, we're seeing a rethinking of why and how long we are incarcerating people in this country. For example, I recently heard that Governor Schwarzenegger in California is reconsidering, particularly, and is beginning to pardon some of the older prisoners. I think that's something that many states need to really look at in terms of what we know. Every study that has ever been done on older prisoners says once you get above the age of 45, your risk in terms of committing violent crimes is so nil to none that it really doesn't make sense for us to continue to spend $25,000 a year to incarcerate you. And that is particularly related to life without parolers.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really need to, like, think, because we spend $65 billion a year on incarceration. We are becoming...
Hey, we're number one.
We're number one.
We're number,
we are number
one in the world.
That's right. Unlike the NCAA March Madness, this is not something to be proud of, to
right.
be number one.
Yeah.
And we incarcerate more people in this world than mm-hmm. I think any other country. 1 in 100 persons in this country are in prison or jail at any day of the week.
And the disparity on African-American males is causing generational issues.
And on any given day, 1 in 15 African-American males are in prison in this country. And on any given day, 1 in 9 African-American males between 18 and 34 are in prison.
Yeah. Jesselyn McCurdy, thanks for the work you're doing. I hope it really achieves some good results.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for the American Civil Liberties Union on every front, on FISA, on Guantanamo, and torture. You folks are doing a lot of great work. Give my best to Anthony Romero,
will
you?
Thank you.
I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You can drop me an email. It's peter@peterbcollins.com. And Tom will return tomorrow, right here on Air America.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.